We're good to go? Okay. Morning, everybody. It's good to be here. Greetings from the evening Bible study. I don't know if you all do what we do, but we only have two small groups, so we have competitions to see who has more in their small group each week. Although I found out last night that the people in the other small group didn't realize my group was competing with them. I said, yeah, that we did that on purpose because it's easier for us to win. I don't know if you've ever noticed this or not, but I pretty much do the same outline every time I speak, which is we're going to walk through the passage. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to walk through this passage and see what the Lord has shown us. I'm thinking 56 verses, 30 minutes. Wow. But that's what we're going to do. And especially what really struck me as I studied this passage is we literally could take an entire women's Bible study year and delve into this passage. So here we go. Luke 23, verse 1. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. This is an amazing verse. You're wondering, why is this an amazing verse? Well, the whole assembly that's referenced here goes back to verse 66 in chapter 22, where it says, at daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and teachers of the law, met together. And then they made this decision. This is when they had the trial there of Jesus. What we have to understand, and what makes this first verse in chapter 23 so amazing, is that he didn't just say the council of the elders. This council is made up of two groups, the chief priests and then the teachers of the law. And these two groups hated each other. They despised each other. They had different theologies. And so you can imagine when they were normally meeting together, these two groups going at each other. But what has happened in these verses is that they have come together. This is one of those situations where the enemy of my enemy, in this situation Jesus, is my friend. And so these two bands in this one group come together and come before Pilate to what? To accuse Jesus. In verse 2 it says, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king. Now, this is a Jewish group coming before the Roman governor. Why are they doing that? Because even though they have found him guilty of blasphemy, they have absolutely no authority to do anything to him. They cannot kill him, and that is their objective. In order for Jesus to die, the Roman, the Roman emperor, the Roman person in charge, has to be the one to condemn Jesus to die. So even though they originally made this decision on religious grounds, they have to come to the Roman governor and they have to give political grounds for him to pass the judgment on Jesus. So what did they do? We have found this man subverting our nation. What does that mean? It's sedition. He's supposed to have been stirring people up to rebel against the Romans. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. That's an out and out lie. In chapter 20, you remember they tried to trap him. And they said, are we supposed to pay taxes? And he says, whose face is on the coin? Well, it's Caesar. He says, well, render to Caesar what's Caesar and to God what's God. Absolute, blatantly lying about what had happened. And then the third one, he claims to be Christ, a king. What we don't necessarily realize, because we just think of the name Jesus Christ, is that Christ is actually a title. It's the Greek version of Messiah, which is anointed one, which is a royal title. It actually means king. And so they're saying, here's this king of the Jews who's stirring up people as if he's trying to overthrow Rome. So Pilate, in verse 3, he says, so Pilate asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? I mean, think about this. Here's Jesus. He's been up all night. He's already been beaten. He's standing there quietly. And Pilate is no idiot. He's thinking, first of all, since when do the Jewish leaders care about looking out for the interests of the Roman Empire? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's already suspicious right there. And then you see this man, this bloodied, quiet man, standing there. I mean, it's not like this is a Rambo in there. This, here is Jesus, and it seems probably the most ludicrous thing in the world that they should be suggesting that this, that Jesus has this interest. But he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? Now, Jesus, it's an unusual question to put to him, because on the one hand, well, he's not a king in the sense that he has some designs to overthrow the Roman government. He doesn't have any interest in taking over some political territory or some geographic territory or something like that. But he truly is the king of the Jews. And so he says this, much like he did in the previous trial before the Sanhedrin. Well, yes, it is as you say. He's saying it almost in a reluctant way, not because he's afraid of the answer, but because it's not quite the kind of question that was being asked, and yet it was still true. But then look how Pilate immediately answers. He announces to the chief priests in the crowd, I find no basis for a charge against him. Now, in Roman justice, that should have been the end of the story. Jesus has just been declared innocent, not guilty. He should be free to go immediately. But what happens? They ratchet it up a notch. They say they insisted. He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and he's come all the way down here, a different part of the country. When we start to see in Pilate's response now how he is just trying to distance himself, like he just doesn't want anything to do with this. And so as soon as he hears that he's a Galilean, he realizes that Herod is in town. Now Herod was the guy that was in charge of Galilee. He's actually a Jew, because Romans did put locals in charge of certain areas. And Herod has the authority to put people to death. You remember he did that with John the Baptist. So Pilate's thinking, I'm just going to get him out of my hair. So he sends him to Herod. Herod's in town because it is the Passover. So Herod sees Jesus. We're in verse 8 now. He's greatly pleased because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he'd heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracles. He plies him with many questions, but Jesus gives him no answer. Think about what has happened with Herod over the course of time. You may remember that he had imprisoned John the Baptist, but he actually was intrigued by John the Baptist. He was interested in what he had to say. There was some curiosity on his part, some interest that he seemed to have. But if you also recall, he threw that birthday party, and his brother's wife, who'd now become his wife, which was not legal in those days, her daughter had danced, pleased him, said, "What do you want?" And she said, "The head of John the Baptist." And so he had John the Baptist beheaded. Subsequent to that, when he started hearing about Jesus, he gets a little scared because he's thinking, oh my gosh, this is John the Baptist come back to life. Now, here he is, he's plying Jesus with questions, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law are standing there vehemently accusing him, and Herod and his soldiers ridicule and mock him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they send him back to Pilate. He's gotten to the point now, he's curious, he wants something from Jesus, entertainment, to be surprised, to be impressed. Jesus does not respond. Out of the different people that Jesus speaks to through the course of this story, Herod is the only one that he does not respond to, because Herod had really no interest whatsoever except his own ends. And so Herod's curiosity turns to contempt, and he lowers himself to the same point of the soldiers and mocks Jesus. He has somebody go and get one of his dilapidated old royal robes, and they put him on Jesus, and they mock him. And notice in verse 12, that day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. The very same thing that we had just seen in the beginning of the chapter. Here are these two people, different ends of the spectrum, wanted nothing to do with each other, but they are united in their attitudes towards Jesus. So Jesus is brought back to Pilate. Pilate calls together the chief priests and rulers and the people. Now the people are added to this crowd, and said to them, "You brought this man to me as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us." As you can see, he's done nothing to deserve death. He's absolutely right. I mean, if Herod, as I said, had seen some reason to kill Jesus, he could have had him killed. But he didn't. All he did was mock him. So even if he didn't say, yes, he's innocent, is proved by the fact that he sent him back to Pilate so that Pilate would have to deal with him. So Pilate is again said, okay, I want to punish him and then I'm going to release him. That's what I'm going to do. He's still trying to resisting what he knows is wrong on some level, but really it just doesn't want to have anything to do with what's going on with Jesus. But what happens? With one voice, they cry out, away with this man, release Barabbas to us. Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. What's interesting here, think about this. They're bringing Jesus to Pilate because what? They're saying he's an insurrectionist. He's stirring up trouble. There's no evidence of that. Do you ever remember in the studies where Jesus has gone around saying, hey, I'm the Christ? He didn't do that. He would say to Peter, Peter, who do men say that I am? And he would say, people say that you're the Christ. Or other people were saying it, but Jesus is not walking around just proclaiming himself as Christ. He's bringing people to an understanding, hopefully, of who he actually is. But the last thing he's doing is actually stirring people up. So how ironic. They're accusing him of that, but then they're crying for the release of one who's actually guilty of insurrection and murder. So, again, verse 20, wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appeals to them again. This is the third time. How ironic. The only person who's advocating for Jesus is Pilate. Why? You know, what crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Luke wants us to understand without a shadow of a doubt that an innocent man is being condemned. This is injustice at its worst. An innocent man, Jesus, was innocent. So Pilate says again, I'm going to have him punished and then I'm going to release him. But with loud shouts now, they insistently demanded. You can hear how it's gotten ratcheted up through the course of this, and these interactions. So Pilate decides to grant their demand. He released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. Through the course of this story, Luke makes it very clear the parties that are responsible for the crucifixion, the death of Jesus. And what he's highlighting in these verses right here is the Jews demanded it, and Pilate turns them over according to their will. They are responsible. They're not the only ones responsible, but they are responsible for what happens to Jesus. As we move into verse 26, as they led him away, they see Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. Simon of Cyrene is somebody from northern Africa. It would have been a Jew from northern Africa who presumably was come to Jerusalem for the Passover, just somebody in the crowd that they pulled in. Now, if you can imagine at this point, from other accounts, we do know that Jesus was beaten. Badly, not just this is beyond what had happened originally with the cat and nine tails and in a beating like this. It was very interesting to me that Luke, who is a physician and oftentimes through his gospel has talked about physical healing and physical conditions of different people, through this chapter never does. He does not highlight that in the crucifixion of Jesus. But the reality is that Jesus was a mess. He was a bloody mess. He's had this crown of thorns, these long crowns, pushed down into his forehead. His skin would be flayed. I mean, you could probably actually see, besides the blood, like into his body in some ways. And the reason they're bringing somebody in to help carry is because they want to keep him alive long enough so they can kill him. But look at this juxtaposition that's happening here. Barabbas, the name Barabbas, do you know what it means, literally? It actually means son of the father. Mm. It's Bar Abba, son of the father, small s. And so he's being set free. Son of man, small s, small n, is being set free, the guilty one. And that being in his place is being taken by the one who was innocent. capital S, capital M, Son of Man. And now you have Simon of Cyrene carrying the cross. Now I've heard, I don't know about you, but over the years I've heard stories or sermons now and then where they talk about Simon of Cyrene carrying the cross as symbolic of how we're supposed to pick up our cross daily and follow. Okay, there's something to that. But as I was reading the commentaries, there was something that was so much more compelling to me, and just like, oh my word. That Son of Man, Barabbas, is being set free. And now here's a man carrying a cross. Can you imagine what this experience was for him? He's carrying the cross, which by rights he too should have died on. But he's handing it off for Jesus to die on, to take his place. And that's what's true for us. Like, verse 27, a large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the barren women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry?" He's referring to speaking to daughters of Jerusalem, these women who are wailing and mourning. Now, these are daughters of Jerusalem. This is a different group than the women from Galilee who have followed him and supported him throughout his ministry, and we'll see a little bit later in the chapter. We don't know if they had any understanding of who he was exactly, but anybody seeing the condition he is in, it's no wonder that they would wail and mourn, and especially knowing what awaits him. But here he is, in this physical state, on the way to the cross, everything that's going on, and he turns to them, and he's saying, he's not saying they're wrong necessarily, but he's saying, don't cry for me. Don't miss the point. Cry for yourselves. This is the seventh time he's prophesying about what's going to happen to Jerusalem. He's saying, don't miss the point here. If this is going to happen when the tree is green, meaning when he is completely innocent, and this never should be happening, imagine the judgment that's going to fall on what is dry, where judgment is just. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what's going to happen to Jerusalem in AD 70. The prophecies come true, and the Romans destroy the city. Interestingly, the Christians took his prophecies seriously, and they got out of Jerusalem before this happened. And then we're scattering the gospel throughout the region, throughout the world even, as a result of this. But his point is, don't weep for me. There's no need to weep for me. What he's saying it then, and there's certainly no need for us to be weeping for him now. That was one of the other things I really appreciate about what the commentators were saying. Jesus is exalted. He's at the right hand of the Father. And sometimes with Good Friday services, you kind of go through and you think about all that had happened. And he's saying, no, grieve for the lost. Grieve for yourself. If there's any crying going on here, cry for the sorrow of your own sin and what it has cost. Don't miss the point of why I came to die. That makes sense? Cry in gratitude because I've saved you from this, but don't cry for me. Verse 32, two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they were crucified, where they crucified him along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." It's believed that he was actually praying this as the nails were being driven into his hands and his feet. The last thing that you would expect, here he is. But in these 10 verses, between 28 and 38, we see Jesus. We have just seen him as the prophet, prophesying what's going to happen in Jerusalem. Here we see Jesus as the priest, interceding at the least likely moment you would ever expect to see it. Interceding for those who literally are hammering in the nails, those who are present, interceding even for all of us as we participate in this ourselves. And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. It doesn't say it here, it's believed that the criminals that were being crucified alongside of him were actually thieves, robbers. And it brings to mind that verse, "Will a man rob God?" That's what we have done. God gave his life to us. And what do? We steal it. We say, "This life is for me. I'm going to live my life the way that I want to live my life." But here they have robbed his dignity. They have robbed his followers. They are taking the last bit of anything he owned, his clothes. Because even if in the pictures and everything else, there's always this, at least a loincloth, he would have hung there completely naked and exposed. And of course, then they're going to rob him of his life. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Christ of God, the chosen one." When they're talking about the rulers here, they're talking about the religious rulers. And here they are, sneering. I don't know how many times I've read this verse, but it was the first time as I was studying that this hit me. He saved others. They're acknowledging he saved others. They recognize that. They've known the miracles. They've seen him. They know there have been people raised from the dead. They know he saved others. Let him save himself. He's the Christ of God and the chosen one. These religious leaders should have known from their own scriptures that this is what had to happen. And yet they're mocking him. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." Do you see how each group mocked him given what their sphere was? The religious rulers are mocking him on the side of "if you're the Christ." The Romans are mocking him on "if you're the king," on the political side of things. There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." It was common, customary, that they would hang the charge on the cross over the person that was being crucified. It was written in three languages, so most everybody would be able to see what it is. But here is Pilate getting back at those religious leaders, saying, "This is the king of Jews," rubbing their face in it. "This is your king." He's mocking them. But the fact is, the sign is accurate. He is the king. And so here we have it. Here's the king, the priest who interceded, the prophet who spoke to the women of Jerusalem, representing the entire nation. Verse 39, one of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth. Today, you will be with me in paradise." You have such a contrast here, these two criminals. This one, much like the soldiers, the religious leaders, "Hey," hurling insults, "aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." Demanding, wanting something for herself, himself, prove it. The other one, completely different attitude, so humble, rebuking the other, he says, "Don't you fear God? We are punished justly." This guy is the only one in the entire chapter who, with a humble heart, says Jesus is innocent. He doesn't deserve this. We do, but he doesn't. This man has done nothing wrong. And then he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." This is one of the very few times in the Gospels where Jesus is actually spoken to by his first name. Usually he's called Rabbi, Master, Lord, something like that, but he's actually referred to Jesus. "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And how fitting that is, because if you remember, going back to the Christmas story, beginning of Luke, the angel had said, his name will be Jesus, for he will save his people from their sin. Mm-hmm. And there he is, on the cross, doing this. So you have this contrast between the one criminal who's speaking in angry unbelief, the other one who's speaking in humble faith. These are pointed out, by the way, by Phil Ryken. One of them, who's basically saying, prove you are who you are. The other one who's saying, remember me. There's trust there. One's saying, Jesus, you got to save yourself and then you can save me. Somehow the other one says, no, he has to die first. Then when he comes into his kingdom, remember me. One is looking for immediate deliverance. He wants off of that cross. The other one is looking for salvation beyond the grave. And in Jesus' response, he says, in this one amazing sentence, I tell you the truth, today you'll be with me in paradise. Salvation is immediate. It's eternal. It's personal. You're going to be with me. That's what salvation is, you know. Think about this. What is heaven? It's being living eternally in the presence of God. What is hell? It's eternal separation from God. Salvation here, it's gracious. If there's ever any doubt in your mind that salvation is by faith, not works, this is the thing you want to look at. There was no place, no time for works. It was confessing Jesus is who he says he is. And then his salvation is certain. Truly, I say to you. There was no question about this. Verse 44, it was now about the sixth hour, which means high noon, and darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, for the sun stopped shining. Now, I was surprised, actually. One of the commentators said, oh, this is impossible. It didn't happen. This was a full moon, and the moon was on the other side, so it couldn't have been an eclipse of the sun or whatever. And I'm like, all the other commentators really think this happened. It says the sun stopped shining. Hello, God's in this. The sun stopped shining. There's a reason the sun stopped shining. You know, think about this moment. Can you imagine this? It's noon, and it goes pitch black. We're not talking like it got dusky. I mean, it got dark. If you remember in chapter 22, when they came to get Jesus, you know, he said darkness reigns. Darkness is a sign of evil. That is definitely part of what's going on here. Darkness is also a sign of sorrow and grief. And then it's also a sign of divine judgment. Jesus told more parables about hell than anybody, and he talked about being thrown out into complete and utter darkness. That is what is happening here. And then it says, the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Now imagine this. We're not talking about some little shear that's hanging between something. This veil is 30 feet wide, 30 feet high, and it's layer upon layer of thread. It's about an inch thick. This is not something, if you had these kind of shears, where you could just do it and start ripping it like that. It's not something anybody could just pull. This, it probably weighed hundreds, if not thousands, of pounds. And it tore from the top to the bottom. There could be no doubt that God was the one who tore this curtain. It was the one that was between the Holy of Holies and the holy place. And if you remember, the Holy of Holies could only be entered into one time a year by the high priest. Things had to be done exactly right, or he was a dead man. I mean, literally, they had bells on the bottom of his robe, and they had a rope around his ankle, because if he screwed up and died, no one was going in after him who could survive. They'd have to drag him out by his ankle. How scary is this? So can you imagine, there are priests in the temple because this is Passover. So they're in there, and all of a sudden, I can't even imagine the sound this thing would have made. It rips open. Can you imagine? And wouldn't you be terrified? Like, what are you supposed to do? You're looking into the Holy of Holies. You'd be surprised you were still alive. I don't know what they did after the fact, but I can tell you this had to be astounding and overwhelming, and you had to wonder. It's said that they think that part of the reason that the religious leaders didn't go after the disciples, like they held off going after the disciples after the resurrection, after Jesus had ascended, because so many unusual things had attended his death. It scared them. And I can understand that. So, the significance of the temple being torn, well, what does this mean? It means that the sacrificial system of the Old Testament was done. This was the last sacrifice that was needed. It means that the way to God is open forever. And it means that by faith in Christ that we have direct access to God. I don't think we fully appreciate most of the time that we can go bounding into the Holy of Holies anytime because of what Christ has done for us. And then it says, Jesus cries out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When he said this, he breathed his last. These two things probably happen. You know, you have to write one before the other, but they probably happen simultaneously. And you know, Jesus, even as beat up and bruised and traumatized his body was and everything else, you know, he it wasn't that he died from his injuries. He says, you know, when no one takes my life from me, I lay it down. And so in this moment, this torment, he says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And he breathes his last. And think back to Genesis. I thought about this morning, where God breathed into man, and man became a living being. And here's the Son of Man, Son of God, expelling that last breath. He laid down his life. It was his choice, and he did it. And here the centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, surely this was a righteous man. It's interesting that the only one in this chapter to give praise to God was this Roman centurion. One of the commentators pointed out that it was the people you would least expect were the ones who were most understanding of what was going on. You have this Roman centurion, you have the woman, you have Simon of Cyrene, who got it, the criminal. When all the people who had gathered to witness this saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. Back in those days, like in the Old West, when somebody got hung, it was an event. People would come out, some form of entertainment. Same thing with the crucifixion. But something grabbed these people this day. When it went dark and they see something they've never seen before and experienced it, it stirred up something. And again, I can't remember which commentator said this, but brought out the fact that he wonders that they think that part of the reason that so many people came to faith when Peter preached that day was because they were there. They had experienced this. This was stirring something up in them to respond, understand what had actually happened. All those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. You wonder, what was going on? Was it out of fear? Was it because out of anguish? Their lives were falling apart, everything they thought? Who knows? But they were there, and they were paying attention. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man who had not consented to their decision and action. Apparently, he had not been in that meeting, because they said the vote there was unanimous. But he, nevertheless, is now present. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea, and he was waiting for the kingdom of God. This is a godly man. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen cloth, and placed it in a tomb cut in the rock, one in which no one had yet been laid. It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. What we don't understand, because we don't live in that day and age, is this was unheard of. When somebody was crucified, they left him on the cross. They just left him up there to rot. They left him up there for the birds to eat. This was a sign to people, you don't mess with the Roman government. But Joseph, and it's also unheard of, to have somebody like Joseph, he was obviously wealthy, well thought of, to get an audience with Pilate, he had to have been somebody of some standing. So here he is, going in direct opposition to the group that started all of this, going to the Roman authority and asking for Jesus' body, not done to somebody who's been crucified. You would not want to be associated with somebody like that. But here we see the tenderness as they take Jesus down from the cross and they prepare him for burial. And it was pointed out that they put him, back in those days it was very unusual for one person to be buried in a tomb. You can understand why. But in this case, it was actually important and helpful that he was the only one laid in a tomb, because there was not going to be any mistaking when he rose from the dead. There had been one body in there, and there's no body in there now. And also the fact that he had actually died. If he hadn't actually died in our place, the sacrifice would not have been sufficient. He made atonement through his death. And so they care for him. And then the women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and saw the tomb and how his body was laid in it. So there again, no mistaking, the women knew exactly which tomb he was in. So they knew exactly which tomb he was going to be gone from. They went home and prepared spices and perfumes. They had been faithful. These women from Galilee had been faithful to Jesus, ministering to him throughout his life, and they were going to do the same thing in his death. But they rested on the Sabbath in obedience to the commandment. That last verse just really jumped out at me. I think that would be the last thing I would have wanted to do in that moment. But they rested. And it just reminded me of Jesus' words. If you love me, you'll obey me. Mm-hmm. And so they loved him to the end. Well, I've said this before in talking about Luke. One of the reasons I love the book of Luke is not only the way he puts things together, but I just realize how many people there are. It's all through this chapter. There are people everywhere. And I think my tendency would be to think, okay, who do I most connect with, or who do I sort of identify with the most? But as I spent time just going over and over this and through this, I realized I have to identify with all of them. And I didn't really want to. But think about this. You have the religious rulers. What are they doing? They are accusing and they are lying. Remember, we've talked before, you only have two options in life. Either we image God or we image the one who's opposed to God. What's the one like who's opposed to God? He accuses. He's the father of lies. How am I like that? Well, have you ever said, God, you don't love me. I don't think you love me, because if you love me, you would have done this, or you wouldn't have done that. You hear any accusing in there? They had their own agenda. They had decided exactly who God was, who Jesus was, and who he wasn't. And they were going to press through their agenda. They didn't care who got in their way, including Jesus. Sound familiar? Pilate. Pilate took a different way. He just kept trying to, Jesus was like a bad penny to him. He just kept trying to get away from him, push him away. And Jesus kept coming back and kept coming back. But it's like, nope, even if he knew it was unjust to kill him, even if he tried to get out of it, what did he do? He caved. He caved. This is what other people wanted. He gave in. Herod mocks him. One of several in this chapter that mock him. Phil Reichen pointed out, he said, mockery can take a lot of forms. This one I typed out because I thought, oh my goodness. He said, kings are not to be ignored. They are to be honored and obeyed. If Jesus truly is our king, then we will show his gentleness in our homes, his patience in our trials, his diligence in our work, his faithfulness in our friendships, and his forgiveness for the people it is hard for us to love. Are we living for the king, or are we mocking him by living as if it hardly matters whether he is the king or not? The claim of kingship is not just a claim that Jesus makes about himself, but a claim he makes on us. Barabbas, we've already mentioned, son of man, son of the father, rather. And we're the same. He's an insurrectionist, a rebel, so are we. We have rebelled against God. He's a murderer, so are we. Our sin put Jesus on the cross, no different. The crowd yelling, crucify him. Who wants to think of themselves as yelling out, crucify him? And yet, have we not done that in our own way? Well, here's the other part of that. If you think about it,
if we really understand the gospel, there's a way in which we have to say crucify him. Because if he's not crucified, we are not saved. There is no atonement. Daughters of Jerusalem, have we not missed the point? Have we not cried for the wrong things? Have we not cried for the right things? Our own sin, the joy of our own salvation. Which criminal are we? The one who demands of Jesus, do what I want you to do now? Or the humble criminal who says, remember me, and trusts? And here's the most amazing part, I think. It's that because Jesus has identified with us our sin, what we needed that no one else could do for us, we are now identified with him. We are Christians. We bear his name. We become like him through the work of his Spirit in us. What does that mean? Well, one of the things it means is greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Dying to ourselves, living to him. That if we love him, we will obey him. It's amazing, and it's overwhelming, and it's joyous when we understand all that he's done for us. And he's saying, truly, you will be with me in paradise. And I think we want to join with those women in resting in his completed work, which is what we are in Sabbath rest now. We will experience it in its fullness in heaven, but we're there now because of what he's done. Let's pray. Father, we are undone by your love for us and by what Jesus has done. And I pray, Lord, that we would not take it for granted, that even right in this moment, we are with you in the Holy of Holies, in Jesus, seated at your right hand. Father, I pray that we would rest in you and that we would live believing you, trusting you, and that your kingdom would come. In Jesus' name. Amen.